permit the court to proceed to the next case, the United States versus Walton.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Andrew Greenlee, and I'm here on behalf of Kenyon Walton. This case is before the Court on the denial of a motion to suppress. The District Court found that Mr. Walton lacked standing to challenge the constitutionality of the search of a car that he rented. There are two facets to the standing analysis. First, the District Court found that he didn't have an objective expectation of privacy because he didn't have a license at the time of the rental. I want to be very clear on this point. Mr. Walton had a license at the time he rented the car. He produced a driving abstract certified from the state of Ohio that had all of his driving convictions listed chronologically prior to the date of the stop and through June of 2013. Nowhere.
What did he have at the time he rented the car?
Excuse me, what did he have?
Yeah, when you rent a car, mm-hmm. you show your driver's license.
And he showed his Ohio license to the dollar rent car.
And that it's a license that, I guess, had a picture on it, and it has an expiration date, which is beyond the time of whenever he rented the car.
That's correct.
So on its face, at least, it was illegitimate.
That's right.
If it happened to be suspended, it wouldn't be stamped on there, would it?
Your Honor, I'm not sure whether or not... I can't speak to Ohio law, whether Ohio physically takes your license or stamps not suspended or suspended on the license.
Well, I'm only looking at it from the standpoint of when he rented the car, mm-hmm. on its face at least.
Valid license.
It was not a problem.
It was not a problem when he rented the car. He at least was operating under the assumption that it was a valid license. I don't think he would have given a license that was invalid to Dollar Rent-A-Car. Dollar Rent's car presumably wouldn't have accepted a license that was invalid. Of course, you know, I don't want to proceed on assumptions here before the court because the fact is that he produced his driving history. And if that's not enough to prove that he had a valid license at the time, I don't see how anyone could ever prove it. It was a certified document from the state of Ohio that chronologically listed all of his convictions. So if he had a valid license at the time, under Walker he had a possessory interest in the car, and he had standing to challenge a constitutionality, at least insofar as the license is concerned. Now, with respect to the second facet, whether or not he had a legitimate expectation of privacy as a parolee, I think footnote 5 of Sampson carries the day on this issue. The Supreme Court considered this precise issue, and they said that a search would not be reasonable if the law enforcement officer didn't know that the person was on parole. That's exactly what we have here. Illinois has espoused the same rule as California. The People versus Coleman, they said that the appellate court said that if a law enforcement officer, they said that a law enforcement officer can't subsequently justify the constitutionality of a search by virtue of the fact that, unbeknownst to him at the time, the person who he searched was on parole. And that's precisely what we have here. It's also worth noting that, according to Sampson, the degree to which someone has a diminished expectation of privacy turns on the specific conditions of the parole agreement. Mr. Sampson didn't sign up for a blanket waiver of his Fourth Amendment rights. His conditions of parole are very specific. He waives his Fourth Amendment right to search only vis-a-vis his parole officer and only on reasonable suspicion that he possessed some form of contraband. So I don't believe that he had any diminished expectation of privacy with respect to any law enforcement officer in any jurisdiction under any circumstances.
Would this be confined to wherever his parole officer had authority?
That's right. Yeah, it was...
He's way out of his range for that, right?
That's right.
And the issue would be once he gets far enough away from his parole officer, he has a total expectation of privacy.
No, I'm not saying that he has a total expectation of privacy.
As long as the parole officer, but the argument seems to be if it's not the parole officer that's mm-hmm. doing the checking, mm-hmm. searches, and whatever else he has the authority to do under that particular, what do you call it, release? Or
supervised release, I guess you could call it.
So basically some other law enforcement officer has no authority.
I think that's right.
Other than what appears on the surface.
I think that's right, and that's what the Freeman Court held in the Tenth Circuit. There was a search, and it was the Wichita Police Department. They searched a probationer or parolee's residence, and that's exactly what they held, is that, look, the terms of the supervised release govern, and that since the law enforcement officer was not the parole officer, they didn't have authority to search, so they suppressed the evidence.
Move away from that a little bit mm-hmm. by saying, well, that really wasn't a parole search. It was after he asks about the, can he have a search? They say no. Then they go get the dog, and then mm-hmm. makes an alert, and then it becomes a probable cause.
Right. Well,
I know they changed a little bit from citations, but that's one of your objections.
Right. And look, I'll address that head on. I think it squarely falls within Huff versus Reichert, a case that was decided earlier this year by this court. They lose if it's a dog sniff case, they lose under Huff versus Reichert. If it's a parole case, they lose under footnote 5 of Sampson. There's no way out here for the government. This is an unconstitutional search. And for these reasons, I think if there's no further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Greenlee. Mr. Simonson.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Andrew Simonson. I represent the United States here. At issue here is whether the district court erred in finding the defendant had no standing. Initially, the government points out that the defendant has the burden to establish standing and a burden to establish that he had a reasonable expectation of privacy. To do that, he must show both that he had an objective expectation of privacy and a subjective expectation of privacy. The government believes there's no reason to go any further than looking at the objective expectation of privacy. Numerous factors come into play here. Initially, according to the Seventh Circuit as well as the Supreme Court, the defendant's expectation of privacy is significantly limited by his status as a parolee. The Supreme Court
is... Parole's out of Kentucky, right?
Correct.
He's got more expectation of privacy in Kentucky because the term is limited?
I believe from an expectation of privacy standpoint, it's limited no matter where he is because he is on parole.
It's limited in Kentucky. He only has to be concerned about searches based on reasonable suspicion by his parole officer. He otherwise has an objective
I do not believe that that's what the courts have said.
Parolee cases are easier than I thought they were. If a person's on parole, any police officer can search them without any suspicion whatsoever. Is that what you're saying?
I don't think so, Your Honor. We're talking here about a number of circumstances, the first of which starts out with that an individual on parole has a limited expectation of privacy. In addition to that, here we have numerous other factors. Number one, the defendant had violated his parole. Number two, the defendant had rented a vehicle, and he had violated the contract that he had with that company. He had allowed
Tenants violate terms of leases in many instances, but we still go through a Fourth Amendment analysis when a search is conducted of those. So a tenant who's out of lease, right, who's having contraband in the house or something like that, which probably violates a lease, still has standing to challenge that search. Is that right?
Well, Your Honor, I think here in looking at the cases that talk specifically about rental vehicles, as well as starting out with a lessened expectation of privacy just for being a parolee, the Supreme Court has talked about the fact that being on parole is much more severe than being on probation, that it equates to being potentially still in prison, however you've been released from prison under strict conditions. So you start out with a lessened expectation of privacy. Doesn't mean that you don't have one at all, but you start out with a lessened expectation of privacy just for being a parolee. In this instance, in addition to that, the individual had violated his parole. We believe that that also adds to when you're looking at an expectation of privacy that society would recognize as legitimate and reasonable. You have someone here not only on parole, but you have someone who has violated their parole. He was out of the state. He was out of the area without approval from his officer, his parole officer. He also was in the midst of violating the law, which is another violation of his parole. In addition to that, then, when you look at what was being searched, which was a rental vehicle, which he had rented from another entity, they had a contract, and he violated that contract.
Is that because he didn't have a valid license?
That's part of why it is, Your Honor. He had violated the contract because there was an unauthorized, he allowed an unauthorized driver of the vehicle. But certainly a part of that was the fact that the district court properly determined that he did not have a valid driver's license.
So if we take that thing in sequence, because this is, you know, what you may be saying is that no matter what, no matter where this guy goes, as long as he's, on parole or supervised release, or what was his status?
It was parole, Your Honor.
So as long as he's on parole, he has a significantly reduced expectation of privacy.
Yes.
And by doing, no matter where he goes, even if it's only in hindsight that you find this out, then he loses. It seems to be what the government's saying.
No, Your Honor. We're talking about a number of...
A license, too. He goes to a... This has happened to me once. I went somewhere else. And my wife had to drive the car. It turns out my driver's license expired.
Mm-hmm.
You look at that and say, you can't rent the car. Wow. Okay. So that's what they do. I don't have a check like you do when you're buying a gun. I simply look at the driver's license. If it doesn't say it's expired, and you got your picture on it, then they rent the car. Is there more than that?
Well, here, Your Honor, we're not certain the exact facts as to what Mr. Walton did when he rented the vehicle. What we do know, when the court looked at the facts to determine whether or not he had a suspended driver's license, initially this issue was not brought up by the defense in its motion to suppress. It was brought up by the government in its response to their motion to suppress, and the government provided a ticket that was given to Mr. Walton the day before this incident occurred, and that ticket was for a suspended driver's license. It's his Ohio driver's license. It's the same driver's license number listed on his rental contract. Subsequent to that, at the hearing on the motion to suppress, which was limited to standing only, the district court made that quite clear. At the hearing, and also as part of its evidence, the government provided a printout on the check of the license status from an Illinois state trooper, and that also indicated that the status at that time was suspended.
And the first stop where he said the woman had to drive,
mm-hmm.
Did that require some sort of an electronic search?
I did.
When you looked at his license? They did something more than what they did at the car rental license.
I don't know, Your Honor. That's not facts that were brought out
as part of
the record. There's certainly
the officer concluded that his license was expired.
Yes.
Right? So I'm just wondering if that was on the face of the license or whether he had to do some sort of a search, and then it popped up that it was suspended.
And that I'm not certain. That's not something that was delved into the hearing. Part of the reason is because it was limited to standing, and also it wasn't probed by the defense. What we do know is that he got a ticket on that Ohio driver's license for a suspended driver's license the day before this incident occurred. The next check that was done was by the Illinois State Trooper, which also indicated the state of Ohio, the driver's license, the same number, and the fact that it had, that it was suspended.
There's no question there's a lot of negatives here, and nobody likes to look at this and say, well, look, you find 7 kilograms of cocaine and, you know, not a good guy. But we're trying to look at it, make sure that we're not having to superimpose something here like driving while on parole, period.
And
you lose a lot of rights.
Right, and I don't think that that has to happen. I don't think that's where this court has to go. I think the case law has been clear that you have to determine these decisions on a case-by-case basis and looking at all of the circumstances. So we're not proposing that someone on parole gives up all rights to any searches at any time. We're talking about a group of circumstances here when you start out with a limited expectation of privacy for being a parolee. In addition to that, the court then looks at the fact that this individual had violated his parole, was in the midst of violating his parole. In addition to that, the circumstances of this particular case, which is, I think, all this court has to look at, is that he had violated his rental contract. And if you specifically look at the case of Haywood, we believe Haywood is right on point in where this court said that someone who rented a car without a valid license had no expectation of privacy because there was no way that if that rental company would have known that, they would have rented it to the individual. The court said not only should he not be driving a rental car, he shouldn't be driving any car whatsoever. Therefore, he can have no expectation of privacy. Yes, Your Honor.
Could we return to the chronology of what occurred here?
Yes.
A stop occurs in Illinois by a state trooper. Does he ask for the license of the woman driving?
I'm not certain of that. I'm not certain of that fact, Your Honor.
So then
I would certainly assume, but I'm not certain of that.
Okay. What happens next?
He asks questions. He makes observations of the individuals. He has concerns about what they're doing. The story of their travel didn't seem to make sense. It also didn't seem to make sense with the fact that they had no luggage. They were exhibiting nervousness.
At that point, he then decides that to hold them for 20 minutes, right?
He at some point makes a determination that he's got reasonable suspicion that there's issues here, and he requests a drug dog.
Excuse me. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
And he requests a drug dog to come to the scene.
Do we have a ruling by the district court that was a reasonable actions by the officer to hold him for 20 minutes before the search based on this traffic stop? I don't know. I guess she must have produced a driver's license. She was the driver. Then we have what seems to me to be an officer looking at a Suburban, which I suspect is open in the back, so he's able to just look in and see no luggage, or at least that's his conclusion. So do we have the district judge here concluding that at that point that we had a reasonable stop here by the traffic?
I don't believe we do, Your Honor, because
I don't think we do either.
And that's not that the court found that it was not reasonable, because the court stopped at standing. The court made it clear when he had the suppression hearing, based on the filings by the parties, that he wanted to have a hearing on standing and standing only. It's pretty clear in the record. It's pretty clear in the record from that hearing that was the only thing that was at issue. So a record was not established as to whether or not the search was reasonable. The issue was not the search. The issue was not whether or not it was reasonable. The issue was not whether it was a parole search. The issue was solely whether or not there was standing. The court ruled that there was not standing. So the issue of the search was never delved into, and there was no record established in regards to that, because it just
Your position is Walton never raised it below that issue.
I'm not certain if he raised that specific issue below. I know that they did file the motion to suppress. I just know that the court and the parties never actually got to that issue, never established a record on it, and the court never got there because they limited the review to standing and found that there was no standing.
So if we disagree with the standing determination, this would have to be remanded for further proceedings on the motion to suppress?
Yes, I would believe there's no way.
It would have to be vacated too, I suppose.
I would believe there's no way to determine whether or not the search was proper because it was never delved into. There is no record established on those issues.
The standing issue is confined to the driver's license, apparently.
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think the standing issue, again, is on a multiple circumstances,
yeah,
one of which is the driver's license.
It's not at the time, though, to stop. That's the only thing that concerns me.
I'm sorry?
That's not at the time of the stop, the driver's license issue. That's why I wonder what was found out electronically, because if he found out he's on parole and found out a bunch of other things, maybe there's more to it, but I'm not sure that's where the court went. District court.
You've got a footnote in your brief, page 14, that suggests that the officer who made the stop had some additional information about Walton having breached the lease, but it's not in the record.
I can't
remember the number of the footnote, but I think it's on page 14.
The footnote here is that. The trooper did know about the breach of the rental agreement, but the evidence was not in the record because, again, we were not pursuing the reasonableness of the search.
So that information had nothing to do with the standing question.
Correct. And Your Honor, to the looking at the government believes the importance of the license is that this is under a clear error standard. That the court looked at the facts as presented, number one, through the ticket, number two, through the search that was done by the Illinois State Police, both of which established that the license was suspended. And in a clear error standard here, this court must find a firm and definitive conviction that a mistake has been made. We believe that it's certainly plausible that the district court's review of the facts as they were presented, it is certainly plausible that there was no driver's license here, and we believe that that is a very high standard to show here, and we do not believe that that can be met. In light of the whole record, which again is that the district court was able to look at these. Now, so
no driver with a suspended license has been a rental car has an expectation of privacy in that rental car, or no passenger even, I suppose. No renter of a leased car has an expectation of privacy in that car if their license was suspended at the time of the rental.
Well, I believe in this case, and if you look at Haywood. Haywood stated that that individual who rented that car did not have a driver's license, and because he did not have a driver's license, he had fraudulently obtained that car, never would have gotten it without the driver's license, and therefore did not have an expectation of privacy.
Even if the rental agency accepts the suspended license as sufficient for the purposes of renting. I understand what the contract may say. We got an agent at a counter following Judge Cinder's inquiry, who accepts that suspended license, as apparently occurred with Judge Mannion in various event he was involved in.
I'm not certain where that goes, but we certainly don't have that in evidence here, Your Honor. And again,
when did the trooper become aware, if the record can tell us, Mr. Simonson, about the suspension?
The Illinois State?
Yes, the Illinois
trooper.
State Trooper. When he makes the stop,
mm-hmm.
Are we aware when he finds about the finds out about the status of the license.
I don't know exactly what's in the record. What's in the record is, I believe, sometime in October when he runs the defendant's license. I don't know if he knew that before, and then that was to verify.
There's no indication he did that on August 29th.
Not that I know of, and at that point the defendant wasn't driving. But again, though, in this case being an expectation of privacy of the defendant, the defendant knew he had a suspended driver's license. The law enforcement officer in Kansas had established that the day before, and at that point, if he had any questions about it, he knew about it. So,
why would we limit, if the rule is as you say, why would we limit to automobiles that are leased? Why wouldn't it also apply to, say, apartments or houses? Someone leases, violates a lease condition, they lose their standing, challenge a search of that location.
You know,
why would you distinguish those?
Your Honor, I'm not certain. I think I would need to take a look to see if there are differences that come to property versus rental vehicles. I do not know. We are basing our.
The reason I ask is I'm very troubled that the rule you're arguing for here, I think, could be easily applied to other situations and undo a lot of our standing law.
Well, I think the rule that we're arguing for is specific to this case, where we have someone on parole with a limited expectation of privacy, we have someone who has violated that parole, and we have someone who did not have a driver's license when they rented the vehicle. We believe that that is objectively not a expectation of privacy that society would recognize as legitimate or reasonable, especially in light of the case in Haywood, but also the additional cases that talk about the restrictions on parolees, and again, where we have a parolee that had violated that parole. We believe, obviously, that our position fits within the existing case law that is in the Seventh Circuit as well as the Supreme Court.
Thank you, Mr. Simonson.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Greenlee.
Thank you, Your Honors. Look, if we wanted to parse the terms and conditions of the rental agreement, it would be clear that he would violate the rental agreement by failing to wear a seatbelt or by carrying or loading anything on the vehicle. Look, there's something odd about somebody's Fourth Amendment expectation of privacy turning on the boilerplate of a rental agreement. Okay? Nobody reads that. So to the extent that it's what society would deem reasonable, I think that that's not a fair inference to draw just because he was in violation of the terms of the rental agreement. It's also worth noting that the only reason why he was in violation of those terms and conditions, if you credit us, which I believe that you should, that he had a license, is because he allowed Ms. Smoot to drive, and that was because the law enforcement in Kansas told him, have her drive, right? So law enforcement can't avail themselves, tell the defendant, hey, do this, and then say, well, you don't have standing, I'm sorry, because you followed our instructions and you had her drive, that you can't raise a Fourth Amendment challenge. Something about that is odd.
Mr. Walton raised the reasonableness of the search below?
Absolutely. Yes, sir. He filed a motion to suppress and said the search was unconstitutional. Now, the district court, they said you don't have standing to challenge the reasonableness of the search for the reasons we're discussing today. But whether or not he challenged a reasonable, that's not fairly in dispute. He challenged the reasonableness of the search. Now, with respect to the violation of the conditions of his parole, any time someone is filing a motion to suppress, they're going to be found in violation of the terms and conditions of their parole because they're in possession of some form of contraband, right? So if you credit the government's argument on that point, then they would always win on a motion to suppress. So that can't be the law, okay? Further on that point, look,
I want to understand your arguments. Mm-hmm. You're saying if a parolee is possessed of contraband,
mm-hmm.
he automatically violates his parole?
In most parole agreements, you're not allowed to possess contraband.
Right.
So it can't be the case.
You're saying that's a constitutional violation?
No, I'm saying that it can't be the case that every time someone who files a motion to dismiss, the government can say, well, he's in violation of the conditions of his parole by virtue of the fact that he has contraband, so he has no standing to challenge the constitutionality of the search, even though the law enforcement didn't know that he had the contraband.
Did Ms. Smoot get prosecuted?
Ms. Smoot did get prosecuted.
Did she move to suppress the search?
She also moved to suppress the search.
A hearing on the reasonableness held regarding that?
There was, and it was jointly decided. The district court found that neither Ms. Smoot nor Mr. Walton had standing to challenge
so
the search.
Hers went out on standing as well.
Hers went out on standing, but again, the reason why hers went out on standing is because the district court found that he had no expectation of privacy in the vehicle, therefore, by extension, she couldn't have any expectation of privacy in the vehicle.
Does she have an appeal pending?
She does not.
That less than 262 months, I think.
Well, I imagine so. Either that or she waived her right. If I could just make two quick points, Your Honors. First of all, a ticket, it's only an allegation. It's like saying someone was indicted for a crime, therefore he committed the crime. If Mr. Walton were to take the Ohio abstract to court, he would beat that ticket for driving on a suspended license. He would beat Officer McVicker's email. It's a certified abstract of his driving history. And I cannot stress how much I dispute the premise that he didn't have a license at the time. How else are you supposed to prove that you had a license?
He had in his hand, in his possession at the time to stop this abstract?
No. But after the fact, he presented it to the district court. He said, here is my driving history. The authenticity of that document wasn't challenged. But yet somehow the district court said, well, that is not enough to overcome this unsworn, unverified ticket that he received by an out-of-state police officer in Kansas and the arresting officer's email, right? None of which was testified to. None of which was sworn. They're just these two documents. I would submit, and I would beg the court to agree, that the best evidence of whether or not he had a license is the Ohio abstract of his driving history. There was no suspension shown on the face of that document. The very purpose of the document was to, in the words of the statute, to enumerate the convictions that someone has under Ohio law for driving infractions. There was no suspension listed prior to the search and all the way through to 2013, through June of 2013. There's no way that someone can provide better evidence than that. And I should add also that his attorney provided a sworn affidavit attesting to the veracity of that document and all its contents. His attorney probably was the one who went to get the document from the Department of Motor Vehicles in Ohio. And it showed that he had a license at the time of the rental. So if you can't establish clear error by showing that, I don't know how you would ever establish it. I'd rest. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Greenlee. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.